As a reminder, all parties will be on open line, so please use your mute button. If you do not have one, you may press star 6. This call is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Ma'am, you may proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, welcome to the July 2007 Charm Telethon. Today I'm pleased to introduce Colin Mitchell and John Weiss. They are both associates on the Cassini Edging Team, Boulder, Colorado. They both have received PhDs at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And since then, John is working on primarily simulations of ring and moon ring interactions. And Colin works primarily on D-ring spokes. And today they'll be telling us everything we wanted to know about rings of Saturn and their current results. So why don't you guys take it away? I think, are we starting with Colin or John?
We're going to go John, Colin, John, actually.
Okay.
Kind of change it up constantly.
Excellent.
That way if anyone gets bored with hearing my voice, at least you get a break in the middle. Okay, so this is John Weiss. Moving on to the second slide, which is the title slide, I'm going to start by telling you about some of the smallest moons in the Saturnian system, which are embedded inside of the rings, and then sort of what we can learn from their interactions with the rings about these moons. So going to the next slide, there's an image here of the A ring, sort of the outer portion of it, and you notice there's two dark bands in the middle of the A ring. Those are almost completely evacuated gaps. Now, usually when you find gaps like that in the rings, there's a moon involved somewhere. Either there's a moon inside there, as are in this, these two cases, or there's a moon outward somewhere with a resonance in there that's actually opening the gap. In this case, as I said, there are actually moons in these two gaps. Just for references purposes, the left-hand gap here, the big one, is the NK gap. The smaller one, further to the right, is the Keeler gap. So, moving on to the next slide, here's a close-up of the NK gap, and you can see, first of all, it's not completely empty. There actually are a couple of ringlets in there, which are probably due to the interaction with the moon that's embedded in there. The moon's name is Pan. But you also see on the left-hand edge there, at the inner edge, there are a kind of a wavy pattern. That is the result of the particles moving past the moon, and as they come past the moon gives them a kick and makes their orbits a little more eccentric, so they move inward and outward to the planet, and they kind of wave like that. The reason they pass the moon, of course, is because of Kepler's laws. Kepler says if you're moving, if you're closer to the planet, you move faster. If you're farther from the planet, you move slower. So the particles on the inner edge of the ring pass the moon, and the ones on the outer edge actually fall behind it. Both cases, you actually get waves that are more or less symmetrical, but they happen on opposite sides of the moon. Waves like this were actually used, in fact, these exact waves were used to find Pan back in the Voyager data, as a matter of fact, using a rather amazing bit of detective work. The moon at the time was a single pixel in the Voyager images, which is just barely detection, I think, by most standards, but it's really there. We have images of it now, so. Just another close-up of the NK gap on the next slide here. You can see there's a lot of structure here. There's kind of these braided straw features on the very edge of the gap. These are due to the moon pushing the ring, making it compress and expand constantly. As it expands, it forms these long wake structures. One of my fellow grad students at CU actually was doing simulations on these and was gratified to see that the simulations actually predicted what they saw. So every now and then we get something right in the theory side.
Can I interrupt with a quick question?
Go ahead.
Is image A a zoom out of the one on slide 4?
Of slide 4? No.
Okay. Can you tell us how it is relative to each other?
I'm sure the geometry is actually an entirely different image. I think A is an approach image, actually.
Okay.
From approaching the planet.
But the dark band in the middle is the Encke gap.
Pardon?
But the dark band in the middle is
Encke. Oh, sorry, yes. The dark band is the Encke gap.
And on slide 4, that whole entire dark band that's kind of interrupted two or three times is the Encke gap.
Exactly.
So, okay. Gotcha.
The geometries are completely different in these two images.
So in image A, we can't see the bright band that we can see in 4 because we're zoomed out.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
Okay, so moving on to the next slide, one's titled Keeler gap. When we first actually got into Saturn orbit, right away they noticed a lot of weird features on the edge of the Keeler gap. You can see these little wisps that are labeled A, B, C, D, E, F, all the way through J. Apparently we didn't have a very good naming scheme going. That's sort of indicative of a moon being there. It's hard to make those wisps and let them continue without just completely smearing out into the background ring. So there's always been a strong suspicion that there was a moon here. Actually, even before Cassini got into orbit, there was, I mean, the outstanding question, how did that gap remain open, and doesn't it close up when the particles just sort of scatter out into it? But it took a while to find the moon. 2 years ago, however, to go to the next slide, we found it. There's the moon Daphnis, or as it used to be known, 2005 S1. I think Daphnis is probably a better name. And you can see the edge waves on both sides of the moon that we used to help find it. It's not much more than a single pixel in this image, but we do have enough edge wave information here to start asking some questions. Go on to the next slide. This is where I get kind of text-heavy for a while. The question I'm going to ask here is, how can we determine the mass of an embedded moon, one of these gap moons, from its effect on the nearby ring? The masses of the moons are actually pretty interesting for us, and I'll explain a little bit why later. The last third of the talk, in fact, will be largely devoted to some studies of this. Along with this, we wanted to know when we started into this, if the moonlet can induce a time variable structure, or is it always going to be the same no matter when we take the image? This is important for sort of planning the observations, because if it's going to be time variable, it means we have to come back to the same moon repeatedly and try to take images in different sort of situations. If it's not going to be changing much, we really don't care when we get the images. We just get the best images we can get a couple times and sort of move on. So that is actually a significant question sort of from the planning end of things. And kind of going hand in hand with this is, how does the eccentricity of the moon change the mass and estimates? And what about if the particles are eccentric when they come in? What if they didn't come in on circular orbits either? This, again, is important. If you go and you take a single snapshot and you think you've estimated the mass of the moon, but the whole edge wave behavior depends on sort of when you take that image, you can be fooled. So again, it sort of affects planning, whether or not you need to come back a lot of times to take these images repeatedly. Moving on to the next slide is, I believe, the only mass in the entire talk, I hope.
I didn't include it.
Okay, good. Only mass in the entire talk, we promise. This is the sort of standard analytic formula used to determine the mass of the moon, and I'll walk you through it quickly. Mu is the ratio of the mass of the moon to the mass of Saturn. It's sort of just a standard way we denote these things. AE is the amplitude of the edge wave, so 5 kilometers, 1.5 kilometers, whatever it's going to be. The delta A is how far the moon is from the edge of its own gap. So in the case of the Keeler gap, that's about 17 kilometers. In the case of the Encke gap, Pan is about 160 kilometers away from its edge. So there's a big difference there. And you notice it's squared. So that comes in pretty strong as a factor. And then A cubed, or the A, is the semi-major axis of the moon's orbit, as it usually is. That's also a pretty strong factor in all of this. Just a quick sanity check. Does this all make sense? First of all, as the amplitude goes up, mu goes up. That makes sense. You get a bigger wave for a bigger moon. Delta A goes up, the amplitude goes up, then, well, the moon gets farther away, you'd expect it would have to be more massive to make the same wave. And if you move farther from the planet, the planet's influence is smaller, so it takes a smaller kick to make a big wave. So this kind of all does track. The 2.24 is just what you get when the dust all settles from a lot of algebra, but it doesn't really signify anything particularly intuitively obvious. Now, this is a nice analytic expression. We like these things. It's completely linear on the amplitude, the AE, which means you double AE, you double the mass, so it's nice and predictable. It uses, however, an impulse approximation, which means you just assume the moon gives a little tiny kick to the ring particles only at closest approach, essentially. What this means is, first of all, the moon cannot really change the orbital semi-major axis of the particles that come by, so they always stay on the same location. It just induces a slight eccentricity, so they wave in and out slightly. This also assumes that the particles in the moons are initially on in circular orbits, which may not be a very good assumption, it turns out, for a lot of these moons. The particles, it might be a little bit better. Ring particles tend to have very small eccentricities, although you never really know. So moving to the next slide, here's what we decided to do. We kind of looked at all these assumptions and said, you know, this nice analytic formula was derived 20 years ago. We've got really fast computers sitting around these days that are easy to set up to do these kinds of things, so we're just going to use the computers to integrate the orbits of particles as they pass the moon. Just put in all the equations of motion, see what happens. What this means is we can free ourselves from some of the assumptions. The particles and moons, for instance, can come in on eccentric orbits if they want. Arbitrary phase. Phase here just means where you are in your orbit. 0 degrees phase is closest to the planet. 180 is farthest from the planet. And you just circle around. The particles, however, do not interact with each other in our simulation. Assumptions are always being made for these kinds of things. This is for speed. To do a full-up collisional self-gravitating ring simulation takes a lot of computer power. And we didn't quite want to do this, at least for the initial survey that we're doing here. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, I'm going to show you the results for a circular moon and circular particles, initially circular particles, coming in and encountering Pan. Remember, Pan's the one in the big NK gap there. It's pretty far from the edge of its ring. And you see two lines. The solid green line is the result of our simulation, and the red dashed line is the result of the impulse approximation, that formula from earlier. And they lie pretty close together. There's only a slight deviation. If you look at the dotted lines way down the lower left-hand corner, starting at 1.6 kilometers amplitude, going over to the lines and down, they give the estimated mass of Pan based upon the two formulas. And you can see they're pretty close together. In fact, they're only about 3% different. When I first saw this, my first reaction was, wow, that really made this entire thing not worth doing. 3%, you know, is actually well less than the measurement error we have going on. So it didn't really improve anything for us.
What's the units on your mass there?
It's ratio to the mass of Saturn, actually. So
oh, okay.
1 kilogram just multiply by 5.68 times 10 to the 26th.
Okay.
I carry that number around, but I... All right, see. To move on to the next slide, Daphnis shows a rather different situation here. Daphnis deviates quite a lot. The lines mean the same thing this time. First of all, it's the amplitude of that edge wave is 4.5 kilometers, so it's about 3 times larger than Pan's. Remember, though, it's also about 10 times closer to its edge. The difference between the two approximations, or the two mass estimates in this case, is about 35%. Even in astrophysics, that's a fairly significant amount. For one thing, this is going to change our density estimates of the moon by 35%, which can be a lot when you're hovering around 1. Dropping down by 35% takes you from ice to something that's got a lot of pore space in it, for instance. So clearly in this case, the sort of analytic approximation didn't work very well. The reason why, in retrospect, isn't very surprising. It's because Daphnis is so close to the edge of its ring. The edge is sort of in Daphnis's chaotic zone. When you get that close, you get these massive kicks from the moon, and the sort of the linear theory just completely breaks down. Like I say, not shocking in retrospect, but it was good to actually see this pan out and show a result that actually meant something, made it the whole thing worth having done.
So the eccentricity that you are now accounting for that was getting assumed out before is important?
So far, we haven't put any initial eccentricities into either body. This is just looking at what happens on circular orbit.
Okay, I thought you said particles and moons can have eccentric.
We can, and actually that's the very next slide. We're going to sort of relax that assumption. This is just the first pass.
Okay.
See how well the analytic theory works and sort of the area where it's supposed to work. And the answer is for Pan, it works quite well. And for Daphnis, it doesn't work very well at all. And as you get to smaller and smaller moons, it's probably going to get worse and worse. We kind of figure it's going to happen. So moving on to the next slide, let's go ahead and relax that assumption. Find out what does eccentricity do to these things. So in the following runs, I'm going to give either the moon or the particle an eccentricity initially. So they're going to not come in circular orbits anymore. Always one of them will be circular. I'm not going to free up both at the same time because that just leads to all kinds of madness. The eccentricity I'm giving to both is going to be the same in both cases, in these cases. So we can kind of compare apples to apples here. But give the ring particles much smaller eccentricities. You don't really know what you're comparing anymore. And we're going to observe the variations in the change in position. The dx is the change in separation from the moon, and the AE, the amplitude of the variation. In this case, it's not going to be the amplitude of the edge wave anymore, and I'll explain why in a minute, but just can't trust it completely anymore for to be that. So moving on to the next slide, here's what Daphnis does if it's eccentric. I've given it the eccentricity that's the current best estimated one from spacecraft navigation estimates. It's got actually a pretty good eccentricity. It moves in and out by plus or minus almost 5 kilometers. So when you're in a 35-kilometer wide gap, that's actually a pretty substantial variation right there. So the solid line shows what happens if the moon's eccentric, and the dotted line is what happens if the particles come in at cosmic eccentricity. So, so I'm going to actually reverse the order here and start at the bottom plot. See what happens to the particles' positions relative to the moon. It turns out that these two curves, the solid and the dashed curve, or dotted curves in the bottom there, are actually pretty much the exact same curve, just shifted 180 degrees apart. In theory, that's exactly what you predict. What only matters is sort of the relative positions, how close they get to each other when they encounter each other, not which one has the eccentricity. But you do notice that the particles get pushed back quite far in some cases, almost 15 kilometers. Remember, the analytic theory said that this shouldn't happen at all. And this is kind of telling us part of why the analytic theory broke down. It didn't take this into account, and it's an important factor in this case. The top plot is actually far more confusing and mysterious, and I cannot actually fully explain all of its behavior, at least not yet. First of all, these plots are not identical if you shift them 180 degrees. You can kind of tell by looking at the minimum areas. One's got a broad, shallow minimum, one's got a little dip at the bottom. They do have about the same maximum amplitudes, however. What you're seeing is that there's a huge variation across sort of the encounter phase. If the moon or particles has closest approach to Saturn or its farthest approach to Saturn or what, with AE, the amplitude, the kick it gets. It goes from a little over 20 kilometers to down around 2 or 3. That's a factor of 10. That's a factor of 10 in the mass estimates if you just saw that edge wave right there. I mean, that is very significant. Again, to tease my astrophysics friends, even in their field, a factor of 10 matters. And certainly in planetary science, it does. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, this actually is an important point. As I said, we have measured a pretty large eccentricity in Daphnis. This image was taken last September from Cassini, and you can see Daphnis is in the middle, and there are edge waves on both sides. The edge wave on the right-hand side has a pretty large amplitude. The one on the left is almost negligible. It's almost impossible to see there's an edge wave there for sure. Clearly, it's perturbing its different edges differently. If you remember from the discovery image I showed at the start of the talk, things look pretty symmetric at that point, so clearly there is a time variable change here going on. So now I'm going to make things even more confusing for our perspective. If you go to the next slide, why is AE no longer amplitude in this case? Well, before, the particles all got the exact same kick, and so they move in the same sinusoidal pattern. So if you took a snapshot at different times, the only thing you'd see different would be exactly which particles were where. They'd all follow the same paths. They no longer do that. When you take a snapshot, you get all kinds of particles that encounter the moon in different phases. This complicates things. So if you go to the next slide, I'll show you how. You see four different slides showing, different plots showing situations when the moon is at four different phases. Just four different times around the orbit on Saturn, if you will. This is what would happen to a stream of particles as they came through and encountered Daphnis. You notice in the bottom right-hand plot, there's a large amplitude to this wave. It's about 25 kilometers total. Well, maybe 20 kilometers total, top to bottom, whereas the slide above that, the one that says 90 degrees, it's much smaller, about 5 to 10 degrees, or 10 kilometers, rather. And you notice these things are no longer these smooth sinusoids. These things even cross each other, which strongly implies these particles should be colliding. So remember the assumption I made, the particles don't interact? That was maybe not a very good assumption for Daphnis, it turns out. I'm willing to admit the shortcomings here. It gets even worse. If you go to the next slide, and you actually allow for a whole swath of particles to come in, not just a single stream, but sort of a ring of them to move in, you can see there's a lot of intersections between these paths. Clearly, an N-body approach is necessary, but you can also see why AE isn't really the amplitude, the edge wave. Since these things cross inside of each other, they're actually cutting through the valleys and the peaks and making them look smaller. So if you took this image, like in the lower right-hand corner, you wouldn't actually see the full amplitude of the largest wave. You'd actually see something much smaller. Therefore, you estimate a smaller mass. So finally, let's get to the movie. I always like to show my movies with these things. So hopefully you can all bring this up. If you hit play, this just shows what happens to the edge as a function of time. Particles are coming in from the right. They encounter the moon, which you see in that little orange ellipse moving around. And then they continue on their ways with their little ticks. So it looks kind of like a slinky rotating when I run this thing. At least I always think so. The individual particles, if you can watch them carefully, each actually move a nice sinusoidal wave after they encounter the moon. But the overall effect of this sort of string is to actually look much more bizarre and much harder to predict. So clearly this thing is pretty complicated. And by complicated, we mean interesting and probably worthy of future study and hopefully grant money.
So, I'm sorry, again, the orange ellipse is showing you where in the...
That's Daphnis.
That is orbit. Daphnis in its orbit.
Right, and the red dot that's on there, that red kind of smear, is Daphnis itself, where it is on its orbit around, on that ellipse.
Okay, and then so as it goes... Sorry, I'm totally here, but... As it goes around, then the big slinky is the radial distance from the moon of the particles that it's passing.
That's the position, the orbital position of the particles, both downstream distance on the horizontal axis and distance from the moon on the vertical.
Okay.
If you took a snapshot of that one stream of particles at those times, that's what it would look like, assuming you believe that things don't collide with each other. They're ghost particles.
Right.
It takes a lot of passes to fully kind of wrap your brain around this. I'm still working on it, to be perfectly honest. At some point, I'm going to try to turn this into a screensaver, I think.
So this is distance downstream from Daphnis.
Right.
And that's because in the images that we were looking at, the stills, that the waves are always ahead of Daphnis?
The inner edge is always ahead. On the outer edge, it's always behind.
Okay.
But they're completely symmetrical. In fact, the equations I used for this used some slight simplifications. You always have to make approximations, of course. These simplifications resulted in a complete symmetry between the two edges. So I could have run simulations for the outer edge as well, but they should have been exactly identical. So it seemed kind of pointless. I cut my work in half.
But then we saw in that previous image that they weren't symmetric.
No, so I didn't show the outer edge at all here. If I had done the outer edge, started things, you know, on the upper left and sent them past going to the right, they'd do the exact same thing.
Okay.
At least they hit better. Okay, so moving back to the presentation, and moving past the movie slide. So what's the upshot of all this, sort of the conclusion, the takeaway message? The analytical formula works, but only for distant moon edge encounters, like Pan. There probably aren't any more of these. Like that. Nearby ones, it doesn't work very well, even if the moons are in circular orbits. And if it gets eccentric, the eccentricity causes time variable changes to the edges. So this means that we have to actually follow the things around. In fact, we are currently working on an observation program for the extended mission to try and follow Daphnis around for a while, to try and watch these time variable changes to better constrain its mass, among other things. And this is sort of always the mantra of these things. We need better observations and we need better simulations. We need to put in collisions and the self-gravity between the particles because clearly the collisions, in the very least, make a big difference, at least for Daphnis. So who cares about any of this anyway? I mean, what's the importance of all this? Well, first of all, this means that the small moons here can have really big effects on the edges of the rings, bigger than the theory predicted initially. I tend to view this as sort of an open hunting license for the Cassini people, and everyone else for that matter, to go looking for these small moons. We haven't seen a lot of them yet. The only one we found inside the rings since Cassini went into orbit was Daphnis. But if the moons are smaller than you would have thought initially, that means they could be hiding from us a lot more easily. So this is a good reason to go back and start paying very close attention to some of the other gaps in the rings where we see some odd behaviors looking for some small moons.
So there are gaps where moons haven't been seen yet?
Absolutely. All over the place, actually. They're C-ring especially, but also in the Cassini division, there are gaps. Odd behaviors that aren't associated with resonances that we know of. We haven't found any moonlets there yet, but we're hoping to. It's always fun to go hunting for these things, although it also causes some eye strain. So the final point here, and this is going to come up in the third part of the talk, the third half, if you will. Knowing the mass of the moons can help us understand their origins. And I'm going to show you how, like I said, later. But first, let's let Colin move on to spokes for us. So let's go from the large to the small, I guess. All right. So can you hear me?
Can you maybe get a little closer to the mic?
Okay, no, my computer's fine.
Yeah.
Let me just borrow John. All right.
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the spokes in Saturn's rings, and on the next next slide, you'll see this is actually a Voyager image. Now, the reason I'm using a Voyager image here isn't just because, you know, they were spotted first in Voyager. It's also because Cassini hasn't actually been seeing as many spokes as Voyager did. Matter of fact, we were in orbit for over a year before we saw any spokes. So this is kind of an interesting thing that we're trying to understand exactly what's going on with that. It's not totally nailed down yet. So basically, this talk, I'm going to tell you what we do know, but please understand that there's an awful lot of work to be done. There's a whole lot of stuff that we don't know. So the next slide gives you a basic introduction. So the observations that we've had of spokes so far, they were discovered by the Voyager spacecraft in 1980 and 1981. The Hubble took a large number of images looking for spokes between 1994 and 2003, I think. But out over time, actually. They initially started looking around the time of the ring plane crossing in 1995, and as the rings opened up to the sun, the spokes basically became, the contrast went down and they became fewer in number. And then, like I said, Cassini didn't spot any until 2005 when they finally recovered them. So this is an interesting thing that we have to explain. Now what we do know about spokes is that they're composed of small little dust particles, which are probably charged, and the features, if you look at the previous image, they start off more or less radially aligned. They can have some more complicated structure to them, but they tend to be radially aligned, and they tend to be kind of wedge-shaped. And the point of the wedge typically is on the side near the corotation point, where the material is orbiting at the same rate that Saturn spins. That's also an indicator that these are probably composed of charged particles. They also usually exhibit Kepler shear. And Kepler shear is what John was talking about earlier. Whenever you have something which has a radial extent, the inner material moves faster than the outer material, so things tend to shear out in azimuth, which is really one of the reasons spokes were such a surprise, because people didn't figure that anything with kind of azimuthal structure could exist in the rings. And it turns out spokes actually don't last very long. They have a lifetime of about 5 hours or so, or less, actually. And the last thing I want to mention is that there's, from the Voyager data, we found that they preferentially form at a particular point in Saturn's magnetic coordinate system. So if you imagine the system coordinates that are rotating with Saturn, there's a particular place in these coordinate systems where spokes like to form. This is another indicator that their particles are charged. All right, next slide.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Let's see, you're talking about why they're wedge-shaped and relating that to...
Right. I have a few dynamic slides.
Okay, great.
On, but short answer is that the particles are affected by the electromagnetic forces because of the electric field of Saturn and the magnetic field of Saturn. And what happens is that the larger the particle is, the less the electromagnetic forces affect it. And so the particles which are, if you're inside corrotation, the particles that are on the leading edge of the wedge, those particles are the big particles. And then the particles on the trailing edge, what's happening with them is they're small and they're more highly charged up, and so they're more or less behaving like ions. They're co-rotating with the planet.
Okay.
So
suffice to say, the electric field will slow these particles down, basically. And so you get this spread because you have different sizes in a spoke.
Okay.
That's what we think, anyway. Okay, so next slide. The contrast phase dependence, this is what tells us that they're made out of small particles. If you look on the left, these are both Cassini images, by the way. I'm done with the Voyager images. On the left, you see a set of spokes at high phase and bright against the dark material of the ring. And on the right, they're a little bit hard, but in the dark region, you can see these spokes. They're dark against the dark background part of the ring. Those are at low phase. And this tells you that the spokes are made of small particles because small particles tend to scatter light forward. They tend to be forward scatterers, while the large particles in the ring that John deals with, those tend to be primarily backscattering. Next slide, please. All right, so I mentioned that Voyager noticed that there was a periodicity to the spokes. This is just the data from those observations. Voyager was able to take images from 90 Saturn rotations, and from this, you got this periodicity diagram, which shows that you definitely have your most spokes at this particular period. It's 640 minutes, or approximately 10 hours and 40 minutes, which is the rotation rate of Saturn. The next slide shows what you get whenever you combine Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 data. That previous one was just Voyager 2 data. And again, you see the peak at 641 minutes. There's also a peak at 611 minutes. This actually has something to do with the SED period, which is very interesting, but we haven't been able to actually verify that yet. As a matter of fact, since Cassini has only seen a few of these spokes so far, none of our long-term movies actually played out. We had a large number of movies before orbital insertion. We were staring at the rings from a long distance away. We haven't been able to verify a lot of this, and so during the extended mission, we're right now trying to come up with times where we can look for long periods of time and see these periodicities again. All right, next slide, please. Okay, I'm sorry about that. All right, so the next slide just shows that the spoke periodicity corresponds with the activity of the Saturn kilometric radiation. Basically, what happens is every 640 minutes or so, Saturn will give off a burst of radiation in the kilometric range. And on the left side, you see that what you look at the activity of these spokes, the images that Voyager took with the greatest amount of activity correspond very well to the longitudes where Saturn is producing this radiation. And if you look at the images where the least spoke activity occurs, again, it's an anti-correlation. So this is pretty good evidence that there's a relationship between the two. And this is what we're trying to confirm in the extended mission. All right. So the preferred geometry, turns out, is, if you look at the next slide, as you can see, there's this particular magnetic field sector. In this case, it's labeled lambda FLS 115. And spokes are most prominent whenever this magnetic coordinate is pointing towards the morning ansa of the ring. And the morning ansa tends to have a lot more spokes than the evening ansa. And then if you wait a quarter of a Saturn period to have this magnetic longitude pointing towards the sun, that's when you get the burst of SKR radiation, usually. So this is just more evidence that there is a connection between these two things. All right, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about dynamics. So for the case of large particles, you usually don't have to worry about electromagnetic forces. Basically, gravity dominates all of their dynamics. But whenever you get down to small particles, and spoke particles seem to be about half a micron in size, once you get down to those sizes, you have to worry a lot about the charging of the particle because the electric field and the magnetic field can push the particles around a lot more. Now, the spokes, as you saw, they don't cover the entire ring. I mean, there's some sort of event which makes the spoke, and so they're transient phenomena, and there has to be some sort of charging event to cause them. And so what I've done here is I've just produced a little simulation where I've taken particles of several different sizes and I've just subjected them to a plasma. The idea being that, you know, some event happens, forms a plasma above the rings, charges up the particles, and then, you know, their dynamics change and they levitate off the rings, and that's when you see a spoke. And whenever you do this, you'll notice that the large particles tend to charge up faster than the small particles. Now, the reason that is that whenever you have a particle in a plasma, the potential that the grain charges to is not a function of the size of the grain. It's only a function of the plasma parameters. But the charging currents are a function of the size of the grain. Turns out that the charging currents are proportional to the surface area, of course, and the actual charge on the grain is proportional to the voltage, assuming they're a spherical particle. And so there's a case where the charging time of a particle is inversely proportional to its size. And so you'll see on the left the red particle is the 1 micron and the purple particle is the 0.1 micron. There's a big difference between the different voltages of those. And then what I did was, in order to let the particles discharge, I just put the particles in basically the background environment that we believe above the rings, and the little particles will slowly discharge, the big particles will discharge much more quickly. Alright, next slide. If you use those particles and you put them in orbit about Saturn, then what happens is the electric field will alter the dynamics of the particles. And what I have here on this slide is I have the angular velocity of the particles around Saturn as a function of time. And you can see they vary, but what's most important is that the 0.1 micron particles is affected a lot more than the 1 micron particles. This is what I was saying earlier. The large particles, in this case, will be moving ahead of the smaller particles if you're inside of co-rotation in this case. Next slide, please. All right. And now I just laid down a large number of spoke particles at a bunch of different points, different sizes. At t equals zero, you got this wedge-shaped thing. This is basically the largest spoke you can imagine. It covers the entire region of the bearing where spokes have been seen. And the idea is that at co-rotation, which is this point is about 112,000 kilometers on this graph, they aren't moving at that point because the electric field and magnetic field basically don't affect the particles at that point. And so the wedge is pointing towards this point regardless of which side of it you're on. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, you can see on the right that the spoke is shearing out. In the next slide, you can see what happens in an hour and 2 hours. As you can see, the large particles tend to move on ahead, and they shear out normally, but the little particles tend to stay behind. This is why we think they've got this wedge shape. All right, next slide, please. Okay, and so whenever you talk about where these spokes or why these spokes form, you need to explain a few things. First, you need to explain the charging of the particles and levitation of the small grain. You need to explain the morphology of these spokes. Some of them are, you know, long and narrow, others tend to be broad. You also see, it wasn't clear in that last image, I'll show you an image later where it is, that you often have multiple spokes forming at very nearly the same location. And of course you have to explain the periodicity with the Saturn kilometric radiation, the electrostatic discharges. And it seems that they might form very rapidly. Based on Voyager images, there's an image where there's two images taken 5 minutes apart. In one of them, the early one, there isn't a spoke there. In the second one, there's kind of a little of a hint of a spoke. So it seems that they might form very quickly. And the two possibilities that we've come up with so far that really haven't been discarded yet are impacts and lightning. So if you go to the impact idea is the original one. It was produced in 1983 by Gertz and Morfield. The idea is that the plasma above the ring I was talking earlier about is the result of a meteor impact. And the idea is that the plasma charges up the dust levitates, and then, as you saw earlier, the dust doesn't exactly move at the Kepler rate. It wants to, but it does more or less move at the Kepler rate. So the dust particles will leave the plasma because the plasma is going to be co-rotating, right? And so what happens is you get an electric field set up in the plasma because the dust particles have moved out, and it's an azimuthal electric field. And then, if you remember from your plasma 101, whenever you have an electric field and a magnetic field and you have a plasma involved, the plasma gets pushed around by the electric field. In this case, it gets pushed perpendicular to the electric field, called the E cross B drift, and in this case it will move the plasma radially. And the idea is that this plasma cloud pushes up or levitates a bunch of dust, the dust causes electric field, it pushes the plasma radially. And so this is kind of the Roadrunner model, where you have this little plasma cloud running along the ring, kicking up a whole bunch of dust as it goes along. Alright. The next slide, the next idea, this is much more recent, just last year, Jones et al. The idea is that whenever you have a thunderstorm on Saturn, then you can have the equivalent of what you see in Earth's magnetic or magnetosphere. You get these cases or these features called sprites. We have these large electrostatic or electric discharges along field lines. Now, on Earth, basically the electrons go from the north hemisphere to the south hemisphere and it re-impacts the atmosphere and basically nothing happens, or vice versa, of course. In Saturn, the rings get in the way. And so the idea is you have this large discharge of electrons moving along this field line, and it comes down, hits the ring, charges up the ring particles, and boom, you have a spoke. All right. So these are the two different ideas. You know, what are their features? If you go to the next slide, the impact model, it really explains the long, narrow spokes well. Again, this is a Roadrunner model. Clusters of spokes, which we have seen, they tend to, you can't really explain those too well because that would imply multiple impactors, which aren't very likely. And finally, there's recently been indications that the radial motion plasma might not quite be as fast as we once thought. So if spokes really do form really fast, maybe that's not so good for this model. The lightning model, on the other hand, it explains why you have groups of spokes really well, because it's the same thunderstorm producing all these spokes, and spokes tend to show up right around the co-rotation distance. And so you would expect to have clusters if you had multiple bursts from a single thunderstorm. But it can't explain the long, narrow spokes very well, because you'd have to have some sort of weird shape of the lightning discharge in the first place in order to produce long, narrow spokes. All right, moving right along.
Okay. Colin, when you say dust here, do you mean ice?
Yeah, it's kind of the jargon that we use.
Uh-huh.
I do mean ice particles in this case. The little ice grains about half a micron in size.
Okay.
All right, so Cassini results on the next slide. Well, Cassini didn't see any spokes until September of 2005, and these are they. There's two little spokes. But, you know, we have been seeing them since then, and so we've started to have a chance to put together some statistics that I'll show you. The next slide. Remember how I said that the spokes tended to show up predominantly on the morning side of the ANSI? We are seeing that as you look at this. There's many more spokes appearing on the morning side than on the evening side. And with the next image, the next slide, the magnetic longitude, on the other hand, we haven't really seen enough spokes to get any kind of significant data out of this. Unfortunately, you know, Voyager saw 90 rotations of Saturn. Saturn rotates every 10 hours. We haven't had anywhere near that kind of opportunity to stare at the rings yet. And so I'm not terribly surprised that if you look at this, you don't see anything. It really just looks like noise to me for the moment. But we're still working on this. We'll see if anything pans out.
But again, were you sort of, to be consistent with Voyager stuff, were you expecting to see more at 115?
Yeah, actually,
or,
in this new coordinate system that we have, it would be at 100.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, we would expect to see a fairly large peak at 100. All right. And finally, just show you the complicated morphology of the spokes. This is probably one of the most complicated spokes that we've seen so far. You can see there's several different spokes here. They're all very long and narrow. They seem to curl a little bit. If you look at the top part, they seem to be a little bit more radial than they are at the bottom, where they're kind of curved in Kepler shear. And, you know, we just have to explain how this comes about, and we really just aren't there yet. So there's a lot of work to be done here.
Did some of your plots suggest that the long, narrow streaks haven't yet evolved into wedges?
Yeah, that's possible. Another thing is that if the charging on the spoke isn't significant, then the little particles will not behave in a co-rotating sense anyway, and so they will move on Kepler orbits too. And so it's a very complicated problem. If a spoke is not highly charged, then the grains will all move in a Kepler fashion anyway. And so, you know, I think that basically the different morphologies of the spokes tells us, you know, the specifics of their formation event. But again, we haven't been able to work that out yet. Any detail anyway. All right, so the conclusions on the next slide. The spokes have returned. Hallelujah. They do appear to be more abundant on the morning ANSA than on the evening ANSA, which is what we expect from Voyager results. We haven't yet seen any significant dependence on the magnetic field sector, but not too worried about that because we haven't seen enough spokes to say anything. And, of course, you know, we haven't yet seen a spoke form, which would be very exciting if we were able to do that, but alas, we haven't been able to. And, of course, like I've been saying all along, there's a whole lot more work to be done. And unless there are any questions, I think I'll pass it off to John.
Questions? Okay.
Okay, I pass.
All right. Moving back to the big particles, the ones for whom electric fields don't matter, I'm going to talk about the growth of ring moons. I'm going to tell the story kind of in chronological order and how we came across it. So first, if you move on past the growth of moons slide to the next slide after that, you see a picture of Pan. Remember I said when it was first discovered it was a single pixel detection. We've got more than one pixel on it now, happily. It looks like a lemon. It is not a lemon. I'm just waiting for a conspiracy theorist to get a hold of this. They will. Just keep moving along here. I just want to show you these pictures, kind of get a feel for the shapes of these guys. Here's Atlas, just beyond the edge of the A-ring. It looks like a flying saucer. No, it is not a flying saucer. Please do not call it that, because people are already trying to. And then Prometheus, on the next slide here, kind of potato-y shape, also has a fairly similar shape to those previous two. Pandora. These are two moons, Prometheus and Pandora. They're the ones that shepherd the F-ring, just beyond the A-ring there. And then Telesto is far away from the rings. It has a somewhat similar shape, though it's a far more kind of round and stubby. So these moons have, first of all, very similar shapes, not spherical at all, you'll notice. They're not quite as irregular as asteroids, though. So one of the goals of the Cassini imaging team was to actually study the shapes of these moons and try to deduce pretty much whatever we could about the moons from just the shapes and morphologies. Now, that was one project that was going on kind of in one end of the team. Meanwhile, another discovery would turn out to have some bearing on this shortly. So moving to the next slide, we had kind of a serendipity. On the left, we have a context image. You see the B and A ring. The A ring is the outer part. And then blowing up, getting closer in, we go to these two, on the far right, two Cassini orbital insertion images. This is where we flew actually right over the A-ring, and we were able to look down upon it on the dark, unlit side. And you can see little tiny streaks circled in here. Now, you're tempted to call those things cosmic ray hits or some kind of noise in the CCD, the detector. But if you go to the next slide, we show that, in fact, these things are aligned, all of them, exactly with the orbital motion at those locations. You would at best expect maybe one of them that could be exactly that aligned. But to have four precisely aligned like that tells you something else is going on. So these little propeller-shaped features must be some kind of interesting feature, or some property of the ring, or something's going on here. So going to the next slide, what was that? Well, turns out these were predicted. A few years ago, somebody was doing some simulations of the rings and discovered a moonlet in the rings. In this case, about 50 meters in size, can create those kinds of patterns by just the way it influences the ring around it. Remember, we created those waves on the edges. Well, if the moon doesn't clear a gap completely, those waves just turn into propeller features. But we were, in the Cassini imaging team, were wondering, once we saw these things, what were we actually seeing with those propellers? Are those the gaps that are opened up, the little tiny evacuations, or are they the places where those particles get shoved? It turns out that the geometry in which these observations were done, on the unlit side like 90 degrees above the ring, looking straight down, is very hard to understand for these kinds of things. A brighter feature could be either less material or more material in some cases, and so we weren't sure what we were looking at. This is important because it's about a factor of 2 in the mass estimate for these moonlets, and we wanted to know how big they actually were. So there's only one thing to do, which is to go to the next slide. Simulations. It took longer than just clicking the buttons, but we did them. You see in the middle there's a red little sphere. That's the moonlet. And then you can see the propellers that they form. The top has particles that don't have gravity with each other, and the bottom the particles do. Both cases you see propeller, but we also noticed something, and completely independent of the propeller, that was also very intriguing to us, which kind of got our brains working, which is the moonlets, those little cores, have kind of grown a whole bunch of particles on top of them. They're kind of glommed on. Little light bulbs went on over our heads and said, aha, we should have thought that this was going to happen. It just didn't occur to us to, you know, go this direction. So if you go to the next slide, I can show you some blow-ups of this exact same property. So at the start of the simulation, you can see the big red core, and the area around it where its gravity dominates over the gravity of Saturn is also shown. So all those little green particles are just the ring particles that pretty much just happen to be inside of that region of influence. If you go to the next slide after that, this is the same shot but from the side view. So if you're actually in the ring plane looking at the core. And, you know, again, there's a few particles in there, but it's not much to write home about. But if you come back several orbits later, I guess 15 orbits later, in the next slide, you can see what's happened. It's kind of like one of those bee beards I always think that people, you know, sometimes wear trying to get in the Guinness Book of World Records. All these particles have glommed on to this core, and you can barely even see the core anymore. There's a little tiny bit of red in there. And if you go to the next slide, you got two side views. One from down the orbital direction and one from end-on looking from the planet outward. And you can see we formed kind of a moonlet here. And again, it's very not spherical. In fact, it's shaped quite a lot like those moons I showed you earlier, Pan, Prometheus, Atlas, Pandora. So what's going on here? Well, what we think is happening, of course, is the moon's gravity is attracting the particles and hanging on to them. But at some point it has to stop. We find. It doesn't keep on growing and keep on accreting material. The reason why, we think, is the material it's accreting does not have the same density as the moon. The particles probably have a lower density to begin with, plus there's a lot of spaces between the particles. They're not tight packed. And vacuum, of course, has a very low density, so that lowers the overall density. It's like pouring marshmallow fluff on a bowling ball. If you look at the overall density of the final object, it's much less than the bowling ball. So to go to the next slide, why does all this matter? First of all, you have to understand the concept of what a Roche zone is. A Roche zone is just the region around the moon where the moon's gravity dominates over that of Saturn. So if you assume a particular shape for this Roche zone, and there are analytic expressions for this, you can actually work out at what point the growth should stop. And it turns out this point has to do with the density of the final moonlet, not with the actual linear size or the mass. The density turns out to be about 0.5 gram per cubic centimeter in Saturn's ring. So what's going to happen here is you start with a dense core and you start pouring on much less dense material that's below this critical density. Eventually the average density is going to drop below the critical density or reach the critical density, at which point any new particle it's trying to get on is actually outside the Roche zone, and so Saturn's gravity tears it away again. So you can't actually grow anything. Now, as I said earlier, the density is independent of the size of the moon, which is a little bit surprising in some ways, but it means that it doesn't matter if the moon is 50 meters in size, 1,000 meters in size, a kilometer, or, you know, 50 kilometers, as the moons I showed you earlier are. So this should have a bearing on what we're seeing with moons like Pan and Prometheus and Pandora. How long does this take to actually happen? Well, it's actually pretty quick, and the simulations takes just a few orbits to completely gather up as many particles as it's ever going to get. Some of the particles don't stick around. There's constantly collisions going on that knock particles loose, but as soon as that happens, new particles move in and fill in sort of the gaps. So this is, you know, a steady state process. A lot of the particles stick around for a very long time. Our thought is that our simulations don't include the idea that particles can weld each other into each other. If the ice gets heated and cooled, you get little bits of melting and things can actually bond together. But in the real subterranean system, this probably can happen. So eventually, with a lot of cycles of the heating and cooling, as you go into the Saturn shadow and back out again, we think you actually may form a fairly solid moon. Does growth always stop, or does it always have to stop? The answer, short answer, is no. And if that's all you want to know, then you can stop listening to the rest of the slide, I suppose. The reason is, if the critical density is below the density of the material that's coming in, the growth can continue forever, because you're never going to reach that cutoff point. Just as a sanity check, I actually checked. Turns out that if you use this theory on the planets can grow as large as you want them to be, which is a nice check, because otherwise the planets all should have something like the critical density they should have orbiting the sun, and none of them do. It's always good, though, to check these things and make sure that they don't come out the wrong way. So moving into the penultimate slide here, this is just a plot showing the densities of the ring moons that I showed you earlier. If you look at the points here with the error bars, they're Pan, Daphnis, Prometheus, Pandora, or Atlas, Prometheus, Pandora, and the two in the far right are Janus and Epimetheus, the co-orbital moons. And you can see the ones that are close to the rings, ignoring Janus and Epimetheus for the second, all have a very low density, around half a gram per cubic centimeter, which is coincidentally very close to the critical density. It's hard to explain that as sort of a shard of a moon that broke up, because you'd expect the density to be somewhere around that of water, which is around 1. But if you believe these things could have accreted, which we do, then this actually does make complete and total sense. Janus and Epimetheus, you notice, are much higher in density, but still below that of water by quite a bit. What this probably is telling us is that these things did accrete some material, but didn't accrete all the way to completion. There wasn't enough stuff out there for them to keep going forever. The ring basically went away around them. So that's where we think the moons are probably coming from. We're still working on revising the theory, coming out, dotting some of the I's and crossing some of these T's here, but it turns out the densities of these guys and working out their masses has a strong implication for where they came from. This also means these things could be recycled. If you break a moon up right now and you leave its sort of core in place, it will gather up more particles. It will be a completely different looking moon, probably. It will have different craters and things like that, but these things can be recycled. So the rings could be older than we think if the cycling is going on constantly. So the final slide is just a pretty picture, the Encke gap with some nice density waves on the sides, and a shameless plug telling you to go and visit our the Cyclops website to see pretty pictures. And at that, we will take questions.
Thank you very much. I have a few questions, but I'm sure other people do too. So.
Fire away.
Okay, I'll start. let's see. Okay, so at SOI, you saw these propellers.
Right.
But they aren't in gas.
No.
So that's telling us that there are moonlets that are not in gap.
Right.
Like, okay, so you started out telling us about moons that are in gaps, but these aren't in gaps, and so does that mean that they're not massive enough to have cleared out a gap?
Basically. What happens is you can start to clear a little bit of gap, but the particles you just pushed have to go all the way around Saturn relative to you and come back again, and that's actually a long period. It's typically something like 100 orbits or something like that, or more. And by the time they come back, a lot of the particles have just diffused through interactions with each other back to where they were to start with. And so if you can't push things far enough away that they can't diffuse back to you in time, you don't open a gap, you just form a propeller.
Okay.
There's a probably going to be a continuum between gap and propeller. Yeah, as you, in that case, drop the mass slowly. Eventually, one will turn into the other.
So the propeller is a lack of material.
Right. At least we think that's what we're looking at right now. The material has to go somewhere, of course, and it bunches up in sort of an embankment on the side.
Huh.
It's a little harder to see in the pictures in the gaps, but they're there.
And then initially you were talking about using the scalloped edges and waves and stuff to get at the mass,
right?
I think, of those moonlets. And then you show us the densities, the estimated densities of these guys on your next to last slide. Are those somehow from your previous work, or are these from different types of moons?
The two on the left, for Pan and Daphnis, are.
Okay.
You notice Daphnis has those massive, massive error bars? That's because we don't completely have a handle on how to get mass there.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't know its shape very well, which is another problem. Both affect the density, of course. For Atlas, Prometheus, and Pandora, we're also using interactions with the rings, but we're using different interactions. For Atlas, you can use density waves inside the rings and see, use measurements of those, these waves that kick up at resonances, to get the mass. Prometheus and Pandora, I believe we get those mass estimates from the interactions with the F-ring and with each other. Finally, Janus of Prometheus, the easiest way to get their mass, since they actually sort of sling off each other every time they get close, they change places. One is inside, one's outside, they swap. You can actually get their masses from that. And so they're actually, their masses are pretty accurate, but their exact shapes are what's causing most of those error bars.
Oh. And then, so I think you were saying that the low densities imply a particular amount of porosity.
Right.
And which you were then linking with the formation.
Exactly.
Okay. And so, maybe you said it, but I missed it. What kind of porosity numbers are you talking about?
In the mantle, so the core is sort of this solid chunk we assume is probably close to that of water ice.
Okay.
Inside the mantle, the fluffy layer of particles that gets accreted, porosity is probably around 50-60%.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty high, but things don't pack very densely.
Right.
So that's actually, from what we found, not that shocking compared to, say, asteroids, from actual measurements of asteroids.
But I'm thinking about Hyperion, which is super underdense, and its appearance, you know, is a result of that, then, like craters and everything. I wonder.
We actually haven't applied this to Hyperion. Something to think about, actually, now that you mention it.
Might be an interesting I don't know if there's any comparison to these.
Right. Hyperion's far enough out that the critical density, the point at which it stops growing, is a fairly small number, like a hundredth of a gram per cubic centimeter, which, you know, it'll never reach. So I think it's one of the reasons we haven't even thought about it. But, yeah, we should at least look at that moon, actually. You're right.
Do other people have questions?
I get a question. This is Ken in Princeton. Have you thought about applying this to Iapetus at all, actually, with that big bulge?
No. Iapetus is actually sufficiently dense that it's not close enough to sort of its Roche zone that bulge would be caused by the same effect. Moons that are that dense actually should be pretty close to spherical.
So you're saying that equatorial ridge must be...
It can't have the exact same cause here as what we have here, so I'm saying.
Okay, thanks.
Which is kind of comforting because all the big moons, you know, are roughly spherical, so at least we have an explanation for why this doesn't apply.
Other questions? I had one about the spokes.
Oh, okay. Call and we'll rush
and
over
that
to...
Is...
Yes?
And again, maybe you were saying this and I didn't quite get it, but at least it seems like there used to be a lot of ideas about how the spokes were seasonally dependent.
Uh-huh.
Is that still the case and it's linked to the magnetic environment?
Oh, yeah.
No?
So what we're thinking that right now, the best idea that we've had so far is that the seasonal dependence is because the plasma immediately above the ring is caused mainly by photoelectrons. And so, if you open the rings up to the sun, what happens is the UV flux from the sun causes more and more photoelectrons to create this sheath above the rings. And what we're thinking happens is, what type of event forms the spokes, whenever it stops, or the spokes leave the particles leave the plasma, what happens is it enters this background environment where there's a large number of photoelectrons flying around, and so the grains would charge up negatively and quickly if there's a lot of photoelectrons. It turns out that, of course, if you have, you know, photoelectrons above the ring itself has to be positively charged, right? And so there's a large electric field that can suck these dust particles back down onto the ring. That's the current idea of why we haven't seen spokes in the region between, like, 1998 and 2005.
Okay, because we expect them to be in summer when the rings are open to the sun?
We expect them to be near the equinox, whenever the rings are not open to the sun, and you don't have this thick layer of photoelectrons above the ring.
Okay.
Because then the particles can get away from the big background ring.
Okay.
Someone's looking forward to a busy next 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
One more spoke.
I actually have a question, just a clarifying one. It's Robert from Salt Lake City. On slide 56, I just wanted to clarify the direction we're looking at on the side views of the accreted objects.
Okay.
The view, if we were looking from the planet looking out at it, would that be the one from along the y-axis?
The right-hand one.
The right-hand one.
I operate in a funny coordinate system where x is outward, y is in the direction of the orbit, and z is perpendicular to the orbital plane.
Okay. So if we were looking at the one on the left-hand side, then, that's as if we were in along with the orbit of the object.
Just ahead of it.
Just ahead of it. Okay. Thank you.
Good questions, though.
I have one more question.
Okay.
And this kind of goes back to my earlier question, but on slide 4, this image of the Encke Gap, I still am not clear on where is Pan? Where is Pan's orbit?
Hang on 1 second. I got to get back to the slide real quick.
Okay.
Remind myself what I'm looking at. Okay. Pan, let's see. It depends on which side of the rings, obviously, we're on. This is a lit image, so we're actually on the south side.
And what does Pan have to do, if anything, with the smaller rings that are in the Encke Gap?
The central ring is actually right on Pan's orbit, more or less.
Oh, okay.
Very close, too. Particles actually right there can never actually get to Pan. They get close, and then they get their orbit tweaked slightly, and so they actually move away. The other two ringlets, I don't think we really understand very well. That is actually another target for the extended mission we're planning to look at.
But you know
the,
that it's
Cornell with Joe Burns and the two Matts are doing this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still getting my brain around the exact geometry. I'm not used to thinking of the south side of the rings, which means post-equinox is going to be much happier for me. Pan should be to the top of the slide.
Yeah, heading around to the other side of the planet.
Right. The material that you're seeing on the right-hand or the left-hand edge, the inner edge there, has passed Pan and is moving down and to the left.
Okay.
I have a question. So, I guess if Pan is in the middle,
mm-hmm.
are there kinks to that, like in the F ring?
There are clumps, like in the F ring. I don't think that they ever found any real kinks. These ringlets do appear and disappear, though. Some images you'll see, you know, one or two of them. Some you'll see all three, and the brightness is just completely changed. There's a lot of time variability. But I don't know they found any kinks.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Also on slide 4, that ring that's in the middle of the gap that you said lines up with the orbit.
Right.
In the middle of the slide, there seems to be a flash mark across the ring. It looks like almost a scratch. I thought it was on my screen at first, but when I move your slide around, it's with it. What is that?
Best guess, that's probably like a cosmic ray hit or something that wasn't completely cleaned.
Okay, so that's on the CCD.
Probably.
Okay.
We constantly have this problem with high exposures. Just cosmic rays hit the things, and they always hit the worst possible spot. Every time.
Thanks.
I've spent a long time trying to track moons that turned out to be just, you know, high-energy protons on the detector. Wasted many hours.
Other questions? Okay, well, if nobody has any further questions, then I will thank John Weiss and Colin Mitchell one more time very much for a very interesting talk. And I'd also like to invite everyone to call in for our next Charm Telecon, which will be August 28th, and the topic will be Hyperion.
Ooh.
So thanks again very much, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye
now.
Bye.
Thank you. Very nice to organize this.
Bye, everyone.
See you next month.
Thank you.
Hi. Hello?